Greetings and welcome to Let's Talk About Books, baby, where we talk with your favorite LGBTQ authors. I'm Anita Kelly, and my guest today is Dee Jackson Lee. Hey, how are you, Dee?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for inviting me. I always enjoy doing these things.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's lucky for me. So we are coming out of a pandemic, and with that, right, you have coming out of a pandemic book, which I really enjoyed. I got to tell you, I got a little sneak preview of it. It is called Forever Comes in Threes. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. And can you tell us, like, the meaning behind Forever Comes in Threes? And like, this seems like it's a story that's pretty close to your heart.
It is. It involves my three rescue dogs, and I'm really committed to rescuing rather than buying. The book, it comes in threes. There's three dogs, but there's like three main characters. There's the two love interests, and then the dogs make up sort of a third character in the book because they're sort of a catalyst that brings the two love interests together on common ground because they're at opposites. And
I found that was unique about your book. Like, I was just telling someone that I've read a lot of books, and some of them have, you know, some animals, but yours, the three dogs were actual, like, they were like characters in the book. They weren't just someone's pets, which was so cool. It was really well done.
Well, they've really been characters in my life, you know, and people, I haven't had a partner for a couple of years now, and the dogs really are, I never feel like I'm alone in the house because they're busy little things, and and they have distinct personalities, and these three worked. I've never had more than two dogs at one time, but these three make up a little pack, and it's really interesting to watch how they interact with each other and rely on each other, and it's so interesting, and I thought it was appropriate coming out of the pandemic because so many people got pets when they found themselves, you know, not with their usual social, having their usual social interactions with people. They found a lot of comfort in having a pet in the house, you know, that you talk to and you interact with. Yeah. And it was had a lot to do with the hanging on to your mental health, you know, when you're so isolated.
Yeah, no, you're right. I know a lot of people, a lot of friends who, got dogs or cats during the pandemic. And my own cousin, he and his wife both couldn't join us at a soccer game one time because they got a puppy during the pandemic and the dog had never, ever been alone. So, you know, they couldn't leave. Yeah. Very different.
So. They are interesting, and their antics are funny, and they're cute, but they're also endearing, and they're so guileless, unlike people. You know, what you see is what you get, and it's refreshing that you don't worry about subterfuge or anything. Unless it's their ploy to get a treat, which they have different ways of doing that.
That's so true. They're tricksters in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the three pups in this book, are they're kind of portrayed after your own three dogs?
Yes, absolutely. They're each of their personalities. It was so easy to draw on them because I know them so well. The oldest one's about 13, we think. She was an adult when I rescued her, so that's just a veterinarian's educated guess. And I've had, I guess the one I've had the shortest time is about 7 years, so I know them pretty well and their little personalities. And so it was easy to write about them. and how they managed to bring these two characters together. The two characters are both podcasters. They have occupations, but the podcasts are part of their occupations. One of them is a physician and a naturopath, and the other one is a efficiency expert. And they both have different ideas about how to make your life better. One's all about balance in your life, and the other one's about being efficient in your life. So they approach these two things differently, and their podcasts end up being in sort of a competition on the internet, and so that's the conflict in the book between the two of them. But they meet because the owner of the three dogs dies, and they get dumped on one character, Perry, the efficiency expert. She didn't know anything about dogs, and Ming, the other love interest, is a physician, but she helps rescue groups. She sort of triages for rescue groups and helps place animals in foster homes and with the appropriate rescue group that would be most likely to be able to find them a home. So she works with several rescues. And so the dogs bring them together in the first place over what to do with them. And the podcast, they don't realize at first that they are the competing podcasters.
And so
it's interesting how it plays out with them trying to find homes for the dogs, and the romance blossoms, and then they figure out that they're bitter rivals on the internet. And so it makes for a pretty good story. I think it's one that will appeal to my readers a lot. Mm-hmm. And it also addresses the individual podcasts address a lot of the concerns that we have coming out of the pandemic. You know, do I go back to work? Do I want to work from home? Do I want a better job? Do I want, you know, all of those things that everybody's struggling with, as the pandemic changed how we look at things, yeah. I think.
Prioritize things in our life for us, or helped us to.
Right. Yeah, it really changed a lot of outlook. And the, you know, with that federal unemployment, a lot of people that were in really low pay jobs that don't offer any benefits, working multiple jobs, they found out what it was like to live on unemployment, which was enough to actually have medical care for their children and be able to feed them, you know, without worrying about where the next, you know, grocery bill is going to, how much the next grocery bill is going to be. And so it's made them reevaluate, you know, should I get a better job? Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to go back to school, mm-hmm. or do some extra training to get a better job. So all of those things I talk about. I write romances, but I try to put something in there that's has to do with real life, mm-hmm. you know, things, issues that we have to, that we find ourselves addressing or wondering about. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the, you know, besides the cute romance, it's I also talk about those things. Of course, I'm not offering any solutions. I'm just
they're there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you know, you're not saying one thing or the other about it. You're just, you know, it's just part of the story. It's just part of, you know, this is the culture that we are in right now. This is what's happening socially. And you know, it becomes part of the book. So, you know, it actually, I think, provides a better feel for the book, because it's really what you're feeling in real life. You know, this is reality. So it makes the book more real, I believe. And I like that you, the two protagonists, you know, neither one, again, are right or wrong. They just have two very different approaches to life. You know, one is be efficient, make great use of your time. You know, that's important. And the other is, you know, you need a balance in all things. And, you know, and so they kind of complement each other, which makes for a great romance.
Yeah. It was one of the more fun books that I've written, for me to write. And also, sort of when I write, a lot of times I'm working out something in my own head, you know, mm-hmm. sort of like a discussion with myself, mm-hmm. as a career journalist. I've been taught to look at all sides of an issue, and that's sort of what, you know, in books I try to do, is to look at different sides of issues. And I don't draw any conclusions on this. It's just, I think that's for every individual to draw conclusions about what's best for their life. Hang on to the job they have or look for a better job. Mm-hmm. You know, I was really amazed at what they call the great resignation. The number of people that once things started opening back up said, you know what? I don't want to go back to my old job. Yeah. I want something better.
Yeah.
Something different.
Yeah. And along with that, I think, you know, companies started to see, hey, we have to take better care of our people because they're going to leave.
And I think that's something that companies had forgotten. They yeah. have forgotten
yep.
that when my dad worked, his company, I mean, when they retired, they still had health benefits paid by that company.
Yes.
There was no question that they would provide good benefits, and it incited a lot of employee loyalty, which you don't have now because mm-hmm. the companies won't take care of their employees for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're all about profit instead.
Yeah.
And so you have people jumping from job to job. It's like a whole different culture. And
totally.
Is that better or worse, you know, mm-hmm. depending on where you stand in that mix, mm-hmm. you know?
That's so true. Yeah. And I think about, you know, my dad was probably like in your dad's generation, that World War II generation, and he worked for the same company all his life, right? And you know, most of that generation did, and now I think like I'll say like maybe millennials, I'm not sure if that's where it started, but they or maybe Gen X, I'm not sure, but you know, they their time with companies really was only for a few years, and then they move on. You know, like resumes look totally different these days than they did, you know, several
yeah.
years ago. But yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said companies were if you were loyal to them, they were loyal to you. And it's just, that's just not the way it's been working. But hopefully, we'll get back to that. You know, I think, you know, people are a company's greatest asset, right? Their employees. And
I think so, but I think the employers have forgotten that.
Yes, I totally agree. Yeah. And maybe this will, you know, has helped them to remember that. But I do see a shift in that. So Deb, you actually had a change in your work situation, right?
Yeah, I did. I was my target date to retire was this past February, about I don't know 2 years ago, my company decided that my job, things changed around, and you know, a lot of this has to do with technology, and I don't fault them for this. My team's job was one that they thought they could incorporate in corporate, and instead of having a copy desk at each newspaper, they could have one central one that handled all the newspapers for that company. And they have a lot, from the Miami Herald, the Kansas City Star. They're based in California, but they own papers all across the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And about 2 years ago, my job in the newsroom in Raleigh, North Carolina, went away. my whole team's jobs went away.
Wow.
And we were absorbed into this corporate copy desk. But to do that so they could hire us in cheaper, because I'd been with the company for a long time and in management for quite a long time, they would fire us and then hire us back at a much lower salary.
Yes.
Well, I was so close to retirement, it didn't make financial sense for me to get mad and quit. So I didn't. I decided I would just work it out, and to my financial advantage. And then in this past spring, well, in the spring of 2020,
it's all a blur.
19, yeah, I just it gets all mixed up now. But they told us that I've been working with the corporate copy desk for about a year and a half, and they sold the company, and the new people decided that they would outsource part of what the publishing hub was doing, and so they laid off a whole bunch of us.
Oh boy.
And it actually worked out to my advantage, because of the time I'd put in with the company, we got severance depending on how many weeks we had worked with the how many years we'd worked with the company.
Yeah.
Translated into weeks worth of severance. So I got paid, even though I got laid off mid-June, I got a paycheck through December.
Nice.
I know.
Can't beat that.
I know. I was pretty happy with it. I felt really bad for the other people. There were only two of us that were in that situation. The others were, like in their 50s and had to go find new jobs.
Yeah.
You know, they had kids in college and stuff like that. And I felt terrible for them, because it's not, it was not only with the pandemic out there, it was hard to, change jobs.
Yeah.
But it's that you get a whole lot of, I'd known some people since 2008, we've been laying off people in the media business. And most of the real experienced people would get, you're too experienced. They wanted to hire people right out of school so they could pay them real low.
Yes.
And so it was very difficult for a lot of my coworkers to move to another job. So I sometimes think I just have too much good mojo.
Nothing wrong with that.
And one person ought to have, that it worked out perfectly for me. And the first person I told that this was happening to me was, I typed an email to Sandy, the senior editor at Bold Strokes, and said, guess what? I'm being laid off. I'm going to have a lot more time to write books now.
She was probably like, woo!
Yeah, even before I told my family or my friends.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So do you have another work in process right now?
I am currently writing one called Here for You, and it's about a barrel racer, a woman who does barrel racing. They're usually connected with rodeos, but they're also sometimes separate events.
Yeah.
My
brother used to do that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He used to, I would be riding, showing like English style, and he would be in the barrel races, So.
Which is a Western style.
Yeah.
And so I've had to do a lot of research on barrel racing, because I've never done it myself. And the whole tier for how you work your way into the national rodeo finals is sort of complicated, because they have different associations and different groups and different, but it's, but anyway, so that's what I'm working on right now.
Cool. When do you expect that to be out?
I don't have a firm date on that, but okay. My deadline to turn in the manuscript is June 1st, the same time that Forever Comes in Threes publishes.
Yeah.
And so I expect it'll come out around sometime the first of next year.
Okay. I will definitely look for that one. That's called Here for You, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sweet. So many of your novels have a horse theme, right? So what's up with that?
Well, I've always loved horses since I was a little girl, and I don't know why. I used to joke around with a friend of mine who's a horse veterinarian, and I said I think that I used to be. We used to joke around and say we used to be horses in a previous life or something. I just always felt a connection to them since I was a little kid, and my family wasn't wealthy enough to own horses, but we had some friends that had a farm, and their dad worked as an auctioneer. He did a lot of things, but he also worked part-time as an auctioneer. Mm-hmm. And he always had some horses that he would buy and then resell later. So we rode whatever was in their pasture. And we were in a really small town, Statesboro, Georgia, when it was really, really small. And and so we would get on the ponies and ride them all over town. That was our way to get around.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, so it was, I loved it. I didn't buy my first horse myself until I was 30 years old and moved to North Carolina. And one of my high school friends was establishing herself as a horse veterinarian in Winston-Salem area. And she helped me buy my first horse, an Arabian, that I loved. And I rode him, and then I ended up buying a farm later, and I had at one time 3 horses.
Wow, that's great.
But the Arabian was always my main man, the one I rode.
Yeah. Oh, that's so nice. So, hence your riding of horses, this deep passion for it. And those are primarily like romance stories, right? That involve
right.
Like the horse world, I'll say. The equestrian world. But you've also written some fantasy novels, right? But I must say, I think those involved horses as well, didn't they?
Well, dragon horses,
right.
Which is an animal that I came up with because I, at the time I hadn't written anything that didn't have horses in it. And so I felt like I had to write about horses, but I kept, and this was before there was anything. It's before the movies, you know, about dragons and stuff. And I don't know why, but I kept having this dream about dragons. And it was before Game of Thrones or anything like that. And
you're a trendsetter.
Yeah, I guess I was. And so I just decided I grew up reading, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and some of those other fantasy authors.
Mm-hmm.
And fantasy is very often a, you know, George Orwell is just a way of commenting on society.
Yeah.
You know, Tolkien did it. C.S. Lewis did it continually. You know, it's it was so I was disturbed about the politics and how they were beginning to be so controversial and competitive and combative. And so I kind of wrote the Dragon Horse Wars as sort of a commentary on society at the time and my dismay at the way we were becoming so combative over politics.
Yeah. It's only gotten worse, right?
Yeah. It's only gotten worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I never really was a fantasy reader, and I came across your Dragon Horse books, and I love all your books, and I love, you know, the horse aspect to them. 'Cause I'm a horsewoman. And so I read your Dragon Horse books, and I loved them. Like,
well, thanks.
Yeah. And it's surprised. I surprised myself because I'm not really a fantasy person, but they were awesome.
Well, there were also romance. Each one of the 3 books is a trilogy, and there's also a romance element to each book. And because I think I'll always write romance. I believe in it. And that's the type of books that I like to read.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, but writing fantasy was hard. It was very hard, especially a trilogy, because you have to have 3. You have to have an arc for each book, and then an overall arc for the trilogy, and keeping up with that. And fantasy doesn't sell as well as romance does. Okay. And so I tried to write a romance book between each Dragon Horse book and keeping up with, you know, all the individual characters, because there's quite a cast of characters by the end of the trilogy.
Yeah.
That it was pretty difficult to do.
Plus
working full time and trying to write two books a year, that was really hard.
Whew. Yeah, that's a lot. That is a lot. Yeah, and you're right. I can see where that would be. Like, if fantasy is really not your thing and you're, you know, kind of jumping in feet first, that I think that would be a very difficult task. But you pulled it off, you know?
Well, I had some good advisors. You know, before I got started, I talked with Jane Fletcher, who is a really awesome fantasy writer for Bold Strokes. And I showed her my idea that I'd kind of fleshed out, and she showed me everything that was wrong with it and sent me back to the drawing board, which was good because she made me think about some things that I hadn't thought about in world building. And Jane, I knew she was a master at it. And so I had some really good examples. You know, I'd read a lot of Anne McCaffrey's dragon books.
Okay.
And I had some, I'm as much a reader as I am a writer.
Okay.
And I don't know that a lot of writers do read as much as I do, but I do that a whole lot more than I watch television.
That's great. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I don't know where you would find the time to do it all, you know.
Well, I didn't watch TV for years because I worked sort of an evening shift on the editing desk. And, you know, I missed all those shows. Now I can binge them on Netflix.
Yeah.
All these shows that everybody else watched, like How to Get Away with Murder.
Oh, yeah.
I never got to watch that when it was actually happening.
Yeah.
And but then I managed to, since I'm retired now and have more time on my hands, I've binge watched a lot of those shows that I missed when everybody else saw them.
Oh, great. Well, I could give you a list. During the pandemic, we've been binge watching so many like British crime shows. If you know, they're awesome, but yeah. So what for, you've been writing for a number of years, like, and you have a number of novels published. What would you say is the most rewarding aspect of writing for you?
My first book I wrote because at the time, it was 2008, and I hadn't quite discovered the wide world of fan fiction. And so I was still going to a bookstore and hunting for lesbian romance. And everything that was on the shelves was old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd read it.
Mm-hmm.
Years before. And so I wrote my own book, and that's how I got started.
Sweet.
But I love the emotional journey of the characters and taking that journey with them. They become like real people to you when you're writing them. And if you really get into their heads, which you need to write a really good romance, and it's sort of therapeutic too. Like I said, it's their stories are sort of discussions of my own thoughts, and I think romance is important. You know, a lot of people poo-poo it, but.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to mental health a lot of times. You just have to, like Tolkien said about fantasy, you have to suspend that disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
and go with the story. And you know, I enjoy the editing process. The thing I don't enjoy is the proposal process. Putting into, like, I have the book in my head kind of loosely.
Yeah.
And when I start writing, I'll even make a loose outline, but sometimes that changes when the characters might go in a different direction. So, you know, when they want a proposal that shows certain elements, I hate to sit. I feel like I'm wasting my time when I could be writing chapters instead of writing out, you know, character sketches and stuff like that. But I just get impatient with it, I think.
So part of a proposal is really putting pen to paper and getting in your characters' heads before they're even, you know, part of your story. Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is, because, you know, a lot of people don't realize this about the publishing business, but sometimes you have to write, like, the blurb, the little thing that you see on the internet that tells you what the story's about.
Yeah.
That's up on the internet, and you might just be writing the first chapter. You know, it goes up that far in advance. You have to do that stuff that far in advance, and then you're sort of stuck, you know?
Yeah, I would imagine. That's rough.
And so you have to really think it out and
be very general in your blurb writing.
Yeah, you do. And so that's kind of an art in itself. That's why most authors will tell you they hate writing the blurbs, because it's just hard to do.
Yeah, because if you're writing that so far in advance and part of that blurb is to hook someone in, right? So you can't be too general because you won't get that hook, right?
Yeah. So, you sort of, you know, and stuff is trendy too. Like, it used to be they wanted us to write them where it left like a cliffhanger. Like, you know, you had to read the story to find out.
Yeah.
Some like a teaser, and now they want more information in them, which I think is giving away too much of the story. But
yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's just the way things trend. Just like grammar is trendy. You know, they want you to do it one way this week. Next week, it's a different way.
Yeah. It's like, I agree with you about, I don't like to give too much away. Like, I think when you go to the movies and you see the previews, you might as well see the whole darn movie in the previews these days. You know, like that's how I feel. Like they show you too much. So.
Or the previews end up being a whole lot better than the movie.
Yeah, right. That's true. That is true. So your characters, right, that you're putting together and building, are they based on real people that you've encountered or people in your life?
Sometimes. Most of the time, I don't consciously think of that, but they're like amalgams of people I know or have encountered.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say in Forever Comes in Threes that either one of those characters is modeled after anybody I know. But in one of my earlier books, Longshot was my second book, and it was my bestseller for a long time.
Great book.
One of the characters in there, the laid off journalist, was modeled after it was sort of an amalgam of two reporters that worked for me and that I found very entertaining. And so I used them to model the Leah character.
Okay. Awesome. That's great. Yeah. I love that book. And that was part of that series, right? Longshot.
Yeah, it was part of the Cherokee Falls series. It started with my first book, Bareback, and then Longshot, and then some years later, Every Second Counts went back to that group of characters.
Yeah, I love those people.
Yeah, me too. I really felt like I knew them in the end.
Yeah. Do you miss them?
Yeah, sometimes I do. You know, I don't know if other people do, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but sometimes I'll read my own books because after they come out, especially years later, it feels like they aren't mine, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's just like another story.
Yeah.
And,
I could see that. It's like parenting, right?
Yeah.
Once you set your kid free in the world, They're really not yours anymore.
Yeah.
They belong to the world. Huh.
So, and I always listen to mine when the ones that have been made into audiobooks, I always listen to them.
Do you?
Too, yeah. I know some authors that refuse to because they're afraid they won't like the narrator or something. And out of all of mine that have been made into audiobook, there's only one where the narrator was bad.
Yeah.
And but the others I've been very happy with.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I know some authors even narrate themselves. They prefer that.
Yeah, I don't think I could do that. I don't have enough. A really good narrator can change their voice enough to, for different characters. Like Kim Bowen was fantastic at it. Georgia Beers did one of her own books, and she did a great job too.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd rather somebody more expert than me at that mm-hmm. do that
yeah.
in my books.
Yeah, like a voice actor.
I think we've learned some things. Audiobooks are becoming more and more popular because you can listen to them while you do other things. You multitask. At least I do.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing yard work or, doing housework, I listen to an audiobook while I'm doing that rather than music. I don't listen to music very much. And I listen to them, when I drive somewhere, mm-hmm. Especially on a trip. And so it's a good thing I feel like I'm making good use of my time when I do that. And on a long trip, you get involved in the story. It makes trips seem shorter. But
so you're more like Perry in that way.
Yeah, the audiobooks are becoming so popular. I think that I'd like to see a lot more of mine come out in audio too, because I think it's really catching on, like ebooks did, when they first came out. And Lynn Bureau, the publisher, the owner of Bulstrokes Books, has been really good businesswoman and been a step ahead of the other publishers and doing both ebooks and now audiobooks. And we've learned a lot. The first audiobooks were, that we went through some different transition. Bulstrokes started hiring their own narrators and producing their own audiobooks rather than letting Audible select what they wanted to make into an audiobook and do it. So they've got more control over it now. And I actually get an email from Rad saying, we're going to do you this book. Is there anything special they need to know about any of the pronunciation of things in this book? Like, Every Second Counts, Bridget Leroy is pronounced Leroy the French way, not Leroy the Southern way. and so things like that, we get a chance now to, she'll say, so-and-so is available. What do you think about her? And Lula Larkin's done the last couple of mine, and she's excellent. Excellent narrator.
That's great that you were able to have her a couple times. Like, if you like her, it's great that they're going with her again. Yeah.
Yeah, I shot Rad an email and said, let her know that I was really happy with Luther. And she said, well, that's good to know. We're using her more and more. So.
Nice. That's nice. So Deb, are you going to any conferences this year since we're kind of opening up the world a little bit?
I am registered for the GCLS, the Golden Crown Literary Society convention in July. I've really missed going to that and seeing everybody and just hanging out and talking to everybody. And, it's just not the same online.
Yeah.
And, all the times that you get to sit around and have a drink with somebody that you haven't talked to in a while.
I think that's where I met you. I met you in maybe, was it Portland at the GCLS?
Probably. I was in Portland. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a long time ago. But that's Portland. Awesome. This year it's in Albuquerque, right?
Yeah. And I've never been to New Mexico. I mean, not, maybe a plane change or something, but yeah. I've never actually been there. So I'm looking forward to that. And I like that we have it in different places every year. So you get to go to different, like I would never go to Chicago to vacation, but when they held it in Chicago, we had a really good time catching a train and going downtown and seeing the sights. down there, and
nice.
Every city has something to offer, and some of them I would never think about actually planning to go to, but when the convention's there, then I get to see, you know, different places.
Yeah, that's one great thing about it. Yeah, it's nice. And it's nice to see, you know, for all our listeners out there, you as a reader, you're very much a part of the convention. You're right there with the authors, and you know, everyone is participating in workshops and, you know, all kinds of fun things.
Yeah, it's fun for me because I'd like to see us have a lot of authors show up, but I'd like to see more readers be able to come, because I really enjoy talking to readers and hearing what they like or don't like, you know, in books. And, you know, we get emails, but not nearly enough that let you know. Here in the Southeast, we have a group of Bold Strokes authors that we hit some of the festivals, and those are finally starting to open up again.
Cool.
Now. And the fun thing is to get to talk to the people that read our books, and to find people that haven't read, don't even know that Lesfic is available.
I know. That's
yeah.
Yeah. It's wild. That's one great thing about having those, you know, like at the LGBT festivals, Pride festivals, you know, just people finding out about, you know, what's available to them, and you know, being able to access that stuff online, like, you know, buying ebooks or just, you know, buying paperbacks, but online, you know. Where they, you know, wouldn't have access to that kind of stuff before. So it's really great. It really is. It's a whole different world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Deb, we are looking forward to your latest book called Forever Comes in Threes. And it is coming out at Bold Strokes on June 1st, and then wherever else you buy your books on June 15th. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I got to tell you, listeners, I read it. I loved it. It's a great book. Really, I highly recommend it. Thanks so much for being on the show. We are talking with Dee Jackson Lee. And Dee, do you have any parting words for our listeners?
I think I consider myself as much a reader as I do a writer. And sometimes I've asked myself if I shouldn't write something more literary than romance books. But I think about it, and then I go, nah. You know, because I think romances are essential to our mental health, to be able to check out of reality and enjoy the emotional ride of the characters and the happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many things in life that don't have a happy ending.
Yeah.
You know, I just think I think that romance plays a very vital role in our mental health, and people don't think of it that way. They think they have to read something more complicated, which I don't. I'm very happy writing what I write. I enjoy doing it, and I'll keep doing it and defend it.
Awesome. I totally agree with you. You know, for me, you know, reading or watching a movie or something is all part of, you know, escaping from reality. Right. And I don't want my, escape to be too reflective of, you know,
yeah,
real life, you know? So I totally agree. And, you know, to prove your point, romance is the number one, selling genre, you know, in the world. So
it is.
Yeah. So, you know, point well taken. You know, that's all the time we have for today. And, again, we're talking with Dee Jackson Lee, and check out her latest book, Forever Comes in Threes, available at Bold Strokes Books on June 1st. And this is Anita Kelly. Thanks for joining Liz Talk About Books, Baby. And until next time, may your journey be lighthearted and peace be plenty. And be safe, folks. And thanks again for being with us, Dee.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.